Harry King was close to incandescent at the best of times, but the state of mind he was in when he heard the news of the massacre could only be described as volcanic. One of those slumbering volcanoes that suddenly go off pop and the calm sea is instantly awash with dirty pumice and surprised people in togas. Moist tried to calm him down, but that was like trying to put a cap on a geezer, and you can't do that, especially not to a geezer like Harry King. Then the explosion became tears, the bubbling and sticky tears of a hard man who would never want anybody to see him cry. Learning that Moist himself had got rid of a few of the dwarfs responsible helped, but even so, Harry continued to dribble snot onto a very expensive tie while calling down the wrath of the gods onto the remains of the culprits, with a footnote that the gods had better get to them before Harry's curses did. Moist offered to tell the workers next of kin, but Harry declared that he would do the job himself. He set off on this doleful task immediately, leaving Moist with nothing to do but collect of the twilight the darkness and the band of Quirmian goblins who had meanwhile arrived at the compound and were being entertained by Biddy Slick and his grandmother. When he arrived home in Schoon Avenue, Adora Bell opened the door herself. Moist, as ever, was impressed by her sang-froid as she surveyed the motley group of Quirmian goblins he had in his wake. "Good to see you again, Spike," he said. "I brought you some little presents. Say it with goblins, as you might say." "How many are there, do you think?" she inquired. 200 or more," said Moist. "I haven't really been counting." "I suggest that of the twilight the darkness takes them over to the Tump Tower, where there's enough room in the basement for them to sleep." "You don't mind?" "Of course not. Quite a lot of my best goblins are taking holidays to the Shires and elsewhere. We're very short. Well done, you." As soon as Moist had seen the goblins on their way, the Ankh-Morpork watch metaphorically felt his collar. As collars go, Moist's was expensive, but a little the worse for wear after the fight with the dwarfs. In this case, the hand doing the feeling belonged to Captain Angua, who asked him to accompany her to the yard in tones that did not allow for an argument. Once ensconced in an interview room, she took down his statement about the massacre in a deliberately methodical way, asking pointed questions, which was to say pointed at Moist. "So you, Mr. von Lipwig, took down a bunch of dwarf terrorists with the help of a number of goblins, yes? You must like goblins, then." "Yes, and so does Commander Vimes, Captain," Moist snapped. "Tell me, where is Chuckles today?" It was worth it to see the captain grimace. If you looked carefully, you could see the outline of the fangs. It was a risky move, but he had a reputation to live down, and cheeking the watch was a pastime he cherished and was very good at. They were altogether too stuffy, and Captain Angua, try as she might, looked stunning in her uniform, especially when she was angry. "With the patrician," she growled. "An attack on the railway is an attack on Ankh-Morpork. With Delvers involved, there is a possible connection with the attacks on the Clacks. All of this needs to be investigated, and it would have been helpful if one of the perpetrators had been left alive and available for interrogation." Moist almost choked, saying, "Captain, when a lot of unpleasant people are trying to kill you, it's hard to remember that leaving one of them alive might be a spiffy idea. You have other things on your mind, such as maybe not dying yourself. If it's any help, I think you'll find that the Marquis des Aix-en-Pins will by now have sent iconographs of the dwarfs who did this. The Marquis is a decent bloke and generally helpful and keen to have the railway, so I'm certain you'll get your evidence." And as he thought that, mischief rose in Moist's mind, and he said, "And I know that you yourself can travel very fast, Captain. They might still be fresh if you hurry." This time, it was not a black look that Moist got. It was a look that said patience was about to crack. Fortunately, the door opened just at the right time, and Commander Vimes entered, his expression grim.
"Ah, Mr. Lipwig, please follow me to my office if you'd be so good. I always know when you're in the building."
He nodded at the simmering Angua and said,
"I'll deal with Mr. von Lipwig, Captain."
Moist was unsure about how much Commander Vimes actually disliked him. After all, the man was so straight that you could use him as a pencil, whilst Moist, on the other hand, despite the success of the post office and the Royal Bank, and even the wonderful new mint, was still seen by Vimes and many others as bent as an old spoon and most certainly up to no good.
"Would you like some coffee?" Commander Vimes asked as they entered his office. "The pot downstairs is always on, and it doesn't always taste of mud." He opened the door again and shouted down, "Two coffees up here, please, Cheery. One black, and you can empty the sugar bowl into mine."
Moist was somewhat disorientated because Vimes was acting in a way that, if looked at forensically, might even have been somewhere within the circumference of friendly, rather like, he supposed, an alligator yawning. The commander was now back in his chair, and yes, smiling. The truth was that between Moist von Lipwig and Commander Vimes, there was a certain, what they politely called, a difference of opinion. Sam Vimes did not live in the same world as Moist von Lipwig. Did the man ever laugh, he wondered? The commander must have done something funny at some time. Probably he'd laughed at somebody falling over a cliff or such like. At which point, to his surprise, Commander Vimes cleared his throat and said, slowly, like a man essaying something unfamiliar, "Mr. von Lipwig, it may be the case in recent years that I've given you the opinion that I consider you a cheat and a fraud and no better than a worm. However, the fact that you threw yourself in front of that train to save two kiddies suggests to me that the leopard can change his shorts. Theoretically, I'll be dressing you down for sorting out the murderous dwarfs involved in this latest atrocity and telling you that you should leave that sort of thing to the damn watch. But I'm not stupid, and I'm prepared to give credit where credit is due. The Delvers are a vicious lot, a type of vermin that I'd very much have liked to see dance to Mr. Trooper's tune, just to show them how justice should be done. But, knowing that at least some of the buggers are out of the way, must suffice for now. So, on a personal note, which I'll certainly deny if you repeat this to anyone, well done." And at this, Vimes waggled, yes, waggled a finger, and in tones of a funeral bell, and much louder, said, "Don't do it again." That was an official reprimand, you understand, Mr. Lipwig, and this is my hand. To Moist's amazement, Vimes walked around the table and gave him the hardest handshake he had ever had. It was like shaking hands with a boxing glove full of walnuts. Nothing actually broke, and there was no blood, and Vimes hadn't even tried to squeeze, so it appeared to Moist that what had just been perpetrated must be Commander Vimes's everyday handshake. He decided it was probably the commander being a man who didn't believe in half measures. Another commander looked sombre, saying, "If I were you, Mr. von Lipwig, I'd make certain that my wife spent a lot of time out of the way in Clax Towers for a while, and I'd ask the watch to keep an eye on my property. Those wretched Delvers will stop at nothing, and I mean no offence when I say I'm surprised that you managed to take the bastards down." He lowered his voice, almost to a whisper, and said, "What did it feel like, son?" There was an expression in Vimes's eyes that told Moist that now, if ever, it was the time for truth. So he, too, lowered his voice and said, "To tell you the truth, Commander, I had some unexpected backup. You wouldn't believe it." And amazingly, Vimes's smile broadened, and he said, "Actually, Mr. Lipwig, I just might. I know a little something of fighting dirty in the dark, don't I just? I was under Coombe Valley a few years back, and I had some backup too, and I don't think I want to know where it came from. Just be careful now. The Grags clearly have your number. You'd better go and see Vetinari, but I'm very glad we've had this little chat."
"Why do you think I'm going to see Vetinari next?"
"I know, because I've just come from the palace. He was sending for you, and I asked his lordship if I could get a crack at you first."
Moist walked to the door, turned round, and said simply, "Thank you, Commander." Outside on Lower Broadway, Moist hailed a one-troll trolleybus, which consisted of a troll with a comfortable pannier on either side that can carry up to four people. And he was not pleased when a dwarf jumped into the pannier beside him. He braced himself for a blow, but the dwarf just smiled at him.
"Mr. Lipwig, how pleased I am to see you. I'd appreciate a moment of your time."
"Look," said Moist, "I'm a very busy man with a great deal to do, and I'm expected at the palace."
"The palace? Allow me."
And the dwarf flipped the correct fare to said troll and gave him the destination in the troll's own language, much to the amazement of the troll. Oh, my, thought Moist. Ankh Morpork, the melting pot of the world, which occasionally runs foul of lumps that don't melt. Moist looked down at the dwarf, which was, of course, inevitable. He seemed to be more, well, streamlined than your traditional dwarf, although smiling in a confrontational sort of way. Not unpleasantly, but with a kind of inner dedication to the smile. He realised that the dwarf reminded him of something. Oh dear, what was its name? Oh yes, a gyroscope, which he'd seen demonstrated in Unseen University's high-energy magic building. In short, and of course this person was a dwarf, he did have the feel of a gyroscope about him, something spinning around an undeclared centre. The insight built itself in a matter of seconds, at the end of which, instead of insisting that his unwanted fellow passenger got out, Moist was paying a lot of attention to the smart little figure. "Who are you?" he asked.
"I am merely a messenger," replied the dwarf. "I am here to tell you something that you cannot ignore. In a sacred place near Coombe Valley, your name is on the list of people to be summarily executed. But do not fret unduly, because..."
"You mean I should simply fret in a duly kind of way, then? So what the hell is that supposed to mean?"
The annoyingly grave face of the dwarf, with its curious essence of smile, was irking Moist. And the dwarf said,
"Well, Mr. Lipvig, you are in a queue behind Lord Veterinari and Commander Vimes, and, of course, so are a very large number of dwarfs considered to be un-dwarfish. It is a tiny war at the moment. It's burning underground like an abandoned coal measure, waiting to break out in unexpected places, and soon, I expect, to a place containing yourself."
"Look," said Moist.
"It may have escaped your notice, but I am not, and never have been, a dwarf, okay? I don't have a beard, and I can't walk under a table. Human, you see?" The composure of the dwarf was unshakable, just like his smile, which now broadened a little as he said,
"You may not be a dwarf, my friend, but you are considered a vector, a symbol of all that is opposed to real dwarfishness, a carrier, if you like, and also a central figure in a city that some dwarfs would love to see burned to the ground. The Clacks were just the start. Your railway will not succeed in tempting dwarfs from the true path of attack. The Commander and Lord Veterinari are surrounded by people who carry a large variety of useful weapons. You don't, though, do you, Mr. Lipvig? You are not a warrior. You are a target. Admittedly, a remarkably ingenious one. I suggest you remember how Albert Spangler watched his back. And above all, do not go into dark places."
The dwarf shook his head and added,
"You have been warned, sir. I understand you have been known to say that a life without danger is a life not worth living. And frankly, all I can say is, good luck with that. Tack does not require that you think of him, but he does require that you think. And I suspect that Tack will be requiring your services in the near future. There are things happening, political things, that you need know nothing of, but Tack knows where to find you when Tack needs you."
And with that, the dwarf smiled, jumped out of the pannier, and ran off at speed before Moist could react. Taken by surprise, Moist continued the journey to the palace with his head in a whirl. Until the massacre at the railhead, he hadn't been doing anything wrong, just trying to help everybody. And now he was apparently a target because he represented the wicked ways of Ankh-Morpork, which was not only unfair but also untrue. Well, probably untrue. Well, at least a bit. He assumed that the Grags were hurt about the fact that he had just killed some of their number, even though it had been a fair fight. Well, probably fair, and anyway, they'd got what they deserved. Moist had hardly done anything truly wicked in his life, apart from occasionally going with a few clients down to the Pink Pussycat Club to appear to have a good time and stick money down the garters of the gyrating young ladies, which really was hardly evil at all in the light of early-onset middle age, just rather sad, although extremely enjoyable at the time, and a death warrant if Adora Bell ever found out. And now his new, cleaned-up, hard-working, upstanding citizen persona was at risk. Moist was seething by the time he arrived at the oblong office. "It seems I'm a damned target," he began, "and you knew it, sir." In the following silence, Lord Veterinari's head did not move until he folded his newspaper.
"I assume the Grags found you, yes, Mr. Lipvig? I thought you knew that, along with myself, Drumknot, Commander Vimes, and many others,
You are on what I believe is called a hit list, drawn up by Radical Grags. But if I were you, I wouldn't worry. After all, a life without danger is a life not worth living, eh, Mr. Lipwig? And Moist said, Well, yes, but what about Adora Bell? Oh, yes, Mr. Lipwig, I told her last week.
What? She didn't tell me.
I believe she wanted to surprise you, Mr. Lipwig. She knows how much you like surprises, and you do enjoy a quantum of frisson, she told me.
Moist almost squealed.
But you know I'm no fighter.
Really, Mr. Lipwig, but I already have reports that say otherwise. Thrilling tales of Dedding do, and believe me, nothing was said about Dedding don't.
Moist, a long-time student of veterinary and his moods, knew that you could never be sure of what he was thinking, but now the patrician seemed carved out of stone like a statue.
Mr. Lipwig, you know what they say about dwarfs?
Moist looked blank.
Very small people?
Two dwarfs is an argument, three dwarfs is a war, Mr. Lipwig. It's squabble, squabble, squabble. It's built into their culture. And in the squabbling, the grags hide and poison. The Coombe Valley Accord, which I helped to broker with the Low King and Diamond King of Trolls, was hailed around the world as a fresh hope for the future. But now some of the senior dwarfs appear to be enthralled to a faction of the grags who are bent on destruction. Differences of opinion are one thing, but this sort of atrocity cannot be borne. Diamond King of Trolls and I are putting pressure on the Low King, and we have every expectation he will deal with the matter.
It has gone too far, Mr. Lipwig. Once upon a time, the grags were bold dwarfs who checked the mines for fire damp, hence the heavy clothing. Of course, that gave them status, but in truth, they were just plucky miners. Expert at mining, perhaps, but certainly not skilled in politics and thinking. After all, you don't negotiate with a lump of rock. With people, you negotiate all the time. The Low King knows it. The grags know it, but don't like it. I am a tyrant, and, if I say so myself, good at it. But I understand the ways of people and the way of the world. Everything is mutable. Nothing is unchangeable. A little give and a little take and a little negotiation, and suddenly the balance of the world is back on track again. That is what politics is for. But the politics of the grags consists only of do what you are told we know best. And I find that rather tedious.
And I find it tedious when your men wake me up by prodding me, said Moist.
Really, is that all? Said Vetinari. I shall tell them not to prod too much in future. He smiled and said,
Mr. Lipwig, Commander Vimes is a decent man, and he spends much of his time telling people what to do, and that is how the watch works. It's not an area where freelancing is allowed. Things have to be seen to be done in the proper manner. There is indeed a difference between tyranny and running a police force. There must be rules that everyone understands. Do you understand, Mr. Lipwig?
The patrician stared at Moist, who said, Yes, I understand. The commander is Vetinari's terrier, and
You, Mr. Lipwig, are useful and a conduit for serendipity. For example, I understand you have just blessed us with more goblins at a time when we need them. Apart from that, I am told by Sidney, the head ostler, that one of our golem horses arrived here declaring, Give me livery or give me death. We had been given to understand that golem horses do not talk, but it would appear, Mr. Lipwig, that you have introduced that one to the delights of speech.
I am impressed.
Lord Vetinari's smile was widening. What a little bundle of joy you are, Mr. Lipwig, he sighed and continued. To think I once fed you to Mr. Trooper's capable hands. He often asks after your well-being. You know, he never forgets a neck. Now off you go, Mr. Lipwig. Your audience needs you.
The Low King's bellow of rage and betrayal when the news of the massacre at the railhead arrived echoed around the state quarters and into every corner of the great cavern. Bats dropped out of the ceiling. In the bakeries, the dough refused to rise, and the silver on the decorative weaponry tarnished. Rhys Reeson sat down heavily on the scone of stone and waved the clax flimsy he had just received.
"Dwarfs have killed railway workers," he shouted. "Ordinary men, going about their business in an enterprise that would be useful to dwarfs as well as humans."
The king looked almost in tears and thumped a fist into the palm of his hand.
"This after Clax Towers," he said with a groan of loss. "This is a message from Diamond, King of Trolls, and he is trying not to upset me, but I think he feels sorry for me."
He raised his voice and shouted,
"And this is the King of the Trolls, our one-time arch-enemy, but now a personal friend of mine. What will he think about the trustworthiness of dwarfs now? Thanks to intelligence gathered by the Ankh-Morpork Watch, including our own cheery little bottom, we have the names of the idiots who did the deed. And now I know exactly who is behind it all."
He paused and glared at the growing crowd.
"Where is Ardent? Bring him to me at once. I'll show him what his idiotic ranting has caused. I want him brought here in chains if possible." "Good heavens, Tack gave us the Coombe Valley Accord, and now the little blister is trying to break it."
The crowd was bigger now, and the voice of the king was even louder.
"I repeat, I want him here, now, today. No excuses, no second chances, no redemption. Let it be known that the king will not let the benefits of the Coombe Valley Accord be turned to dust by adventurers who believe that the past is still with us and belongs to them. All I see is its sterile echo.
And I notice these days talk against goblins who are working in the human industries, such as the new railway and the clacks. I hear a lot of complaints that it is taking work from us dwarfs. But why is that?
Because goblins learn quickly, work hard, and are glad to be in Ankh-Morpork. And the dwarfs? We have factions that bring us down with every flaming tower. Who would trust us after that?
Remember, if Tack teaches us anything, he teaches us to be tolerant of all sapient shapes. Let me tell you, the world changes with every generation, and if we don't learn to surf on the tide, then we will be smashed on the rocks.
By the Low King's side, Bashful Bashfulson picked up the theme. He looked around at the assembled dwarfs and spoke.
"Tack did not expect the stone to have life, but when it did, he smiled upon it, saying, 'All things strive.'"
Glaring at the onlookers, Bashfulson continued,
"Time and again, the last testament of Tack has been stolen in a pathetic attempt to kill the nascent future at birth. And this is not only an untruth, it is a blasphemy. Tack even finds it in his heart to suffer the Knack Mac Feagles, possibly for their entertainment value, but I wonder if he will continue to tolerate us. He must look at us now with sorrow, which I hope will not turn into rage. Surely the patience of Tack must find some limitation somewhere."
Bashfulson bowed to the Low King and said,
"I am your servant, Your Majesty. What would you have of me?"
The king, still red in the face, said,
"I won't have you bow to me, my friend. I rather think I should bow to you. Your words are wise as ever, and will be proclaimed in every mine."
At this point, a dwarf arrived in the chamber at a run and whispered something to the Low King's loyal secretary, Aaron, who looked sombre.
"I regret to report, sire, that Ardent and his friends seem to have disappeared."
"So, the stupid troublemaker has run away," hissed the Low King in barely suppressed fury.
He raised his voice and announced to the crowd,
"They are banished, all of them. No doubt the cowards will find a place to hide, but anyone who helps them will be treated as traitors. Not to me, but to the scone."
In the privacy of the robing room a little while later, the king was pacing up and down when Aaron arrived with the latest report.
"They've caught some of the small fry, but the main players have indeed got away."
As he mentioned a couple of names, Rhys Reeson's face went as cold as marble. Aaron placed a calming hand on his shoulder and continued,
"Albrecht and the folk of his mines are on your side, though many of the others appear to be wavering."
"Wavering?
"That's not good enough. I need their full commitment," said the king.
His secretary smiled.
"You'll get it, I'm sure. There may be some rogue elements still to be mopped up, but we'll get them soon. But do be careful, Rhys. I can see this is taking a lot out of you, and that's not good. And you do have another card to play."
The king shook his head. "Not yet. But perhaps sometime soon, at a point of my choosing, I just have to find the moment."
Aaron smiled again, and then there was the sound of a kiss.
The dwarf Vandal had a stroke of luck. There was Engine 1, right below him, the one they called Iron Girder, and there was no time to waste. He was an expert and cunning, and the Grags would pay handsomely if even one wretched locomotive was destroyed. He dropped down silently from the roof and landed just behind the prestigious engine. It was a good time to throw a monkey wrench in the gears. There were guards, he knew, but they were stupid and sluggish, and tonight they were on secondment and patrolling a long way away. He had checked and double-checked, and so he soundlessly approached the locomotive, alone in her cavernous shed. There were so many things you could do to kill a railway engine, and he had imagined them all. And so, in the dark, ready to climb up again out of the skylight, he unrolled his bag of implements, all carefully wrapped in hide so they didn't clink or rattle, and stepped up purposefully onto the footplate of Iron Girder. And in the gloom, the locomotive spat live steam, instantly filling the air with a pink fog. The dwarf waited, unable to move, and a somber voice said,
"Please do not panic. You are merely dead."
The Vandal stared at the skeletal figure, managed to get himself in order, and said to Death,
"Oh, I don't regret it, you know. I was doing the work of Tack, who will now welcome me into paradise with open arms."
For a person who didn't have a larynx, Death made a good try at clearing his throat.
"Well, you can hope. But considering what you intended, if I were you, I would start hoping harder right now, and perhaps very quickly indeed."
Death continued, in tones as dry as granite.
"Tack might indeed be gentle. Strive as you have never striven. Yes, Tack might be gentle, or..."
The Vandal listened to the sound of silence, the sound like a bell with, alas, no clapper, but finally the dreadful silence ended in,
"Not."
Iron Girder had screamed the shrill, whistling scream of a lady in distress that had cut through the air like a knife, and by the time Corporal Nobby Nobbs and Sergeant Colon reached the shed, running extremely carefully and precisely — Colon and Nobby had lived a long time in a dangerous occupation, and they knew how not to be dead, to wit, by arriving when the bad guys had got away — all they found, besides Iron Girder, was some warm dampness, vaguely pink, a tool roll, and a few fragments of bone.
"It looks like the locomotive fought back," said Nobby. "I know what this is, Sarge. It's Eldritch. Uncanny, you could say."
Fred Colon stepped forward and said,
"It don't look oblong to me, Nobby. Look at this crowbar and tool roll. You can't tell me that the engine lays awake at night like an old biddy keeping a poker beside her bed to fight off burglars. I reckon she was being coy. Lave steam. It's a good job me and you were able to scare away all the other assailants."
"And they was very heavily armed," said Nobby,
speaking very deliberately to make things absolutely clear.
"But they didn't have the spunk to face us, that's what it was."
Water was dripping from the stout girders high up in the shed. Colon looked around and said,
"Hey, Nobby, what's that white thing up there embedded in the roof?"
Nobby squinted and said,
"It looks like half a skull, if you want my opinion, Sarge, and it's still steaming."